It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, co-editors at Eat the Steak. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Welcome back, Maria.
Oh, thank you.
We barely made it here through Arctic Blast 05, but...
What? Was it cold out?
Not really, actually. I couldn't believe it. Last night on the news, it was like 20 minutes of stories on snow.
That's why I don't watch the news on
TV. It was really, really depressing. And, of course, then there was actually no snow to be had. But
yeah,
it's just an allegory for TV news in general, I think.
I wish there was some content there. With the remote, you could send, like, a quick shock or something. Not really. All right.
Oh, well, it sounds like a good idea to me.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that they have been covering on the tube is Dino Rossi proposing a revote, which was interesting that he never proposed that prior. But I actually was one of the people saying that Ralph Monroe had first proposed it. I actually thought a revote was a good idea.
One of the weeks when Maria was not here, we both said it was a good idea.
Yeah, so. And then when I was here, I said, it's too expensive.
Yeah.
Oh, always worried about costs.
Yeah, and my solution was to make them both job share. You know, Dino runs the state half the time, and Christine the other half the time.
Well, I still think it's a good. I mean, if it was a good idea when the Democrats were behind, I think it's still a good idea when they're ahead. But it's not going to happen, I don't think.
No, definitely won't. But the latest news this week is that Dino Rossi and the Republican Party are filing a lawsuit to try to get the election invalidated. Now, the Democrats have come back and said, well, you know, these little problems, these little problems you found, such as dead people voting and some provisional ballots that weren't supposed to be put directly into ballot boxes, but were supposed to be held aside and so that election workers could validate that those folks who filled out a provisional ballot were actually eligible to vote. You know, the fact that, you know, a few hundred of those got put into the ballot boxes in King County and possibly in other counties as well. Those aren't problems that are systemic. Those are problems that are little systemic problems, but are not problems that show fraud on anyone's part. And that's not what Dino Rossi and the Republicans are saying. They're saying, look, these little problems are adding up to a number of ballots that could change the election in Rossi's favor. And so the counts should be invalidated. And in fact, it's not possible for them to go back and do yet another recount and make it come out right to really see what the intention of voters were. And the Republicans really would like a new election. Now, a judge ruling on this case could either throw Rossi's case out, he could rule that another recount is necessary, or he could simply say, well, you got to go back and find these provisional ballots, or he could say that, yes, we should have a revote. So any one of those things is possible, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I really don't think that they will order the revote. It's just too much of a stretch at this point. You know, the Bush v. Gore standard comes in where at some point the court simply says it's too late, there's not enough time, we need to get on with the business of government. And I think that's a lot of what's going to happen here.
Yeah, in the meantime, folks should be asking serious questions about how and why were dead people able to vote in this election, why were some people able to vote twice, and how come some of these provisional ballots were not handled properly. I think people should be looking at the election system and figuring out why there are these problems and how come they're occurring.
Yeah, if you don't fix it now, when are you going to fix it?
Well, we've been saying that we said this in 2000 with the presidential election in Florida. We said it after Ohio in 2004. This is not limited to any one state or any one electoral system, any one county, anything like that. This is something that's a problem everywhere in this country, that we have a very sloppy election system. And you don't have to have fraud of any kind in order to have an outcome where that is just riddled with error. And this is the case the Republicans are making, and they're right about that. But whether they get a judge to order a revote is an entirely different question.
Yeah, and I think the issue here too is we tend to get complacent about elections because we consider ourselves the ultimate democracy here in the United States, or the original democracy, or whatever some people tend to think. And so we don't always pay a lot of attention to what's going on, and we get kind of complacent, and that needs to change, because because democracy is something where people need to be vigilant and you need to be very careful about making sure everything is done right and everyone's vote is counted correctly and everyone has a say in the political process, and we don't always do that here.
Yeah, and if you don't make the decision, somebody else will make them for you, and not always in your best interest.
Well, tied into all this, there was also some coverage this week of that voting machines in six counties, which comprise about half the population here in Washington State, had not had their software and mechanisms checked prior to the election, which Sam Reed had then responded, well, you know, but we did some checks on them. They just weren't the ones that we were required to do, and everything looks okay to me. So that's another red flag.
Sounds like making excuses after the fact.
Yeah, it's not a confidence builder.
Although I will give Reed credit, he has not been the lapdog for the Republicans that Catherine Harris and some other secretaries of state have been, you know, when these controversies have come up. He has been relatively independent minded, so I'll give him credit for that.
Yeah, but he's been doing his job,
He has not been very good on touchscreen voting. There's no question.
Yeah, well, I think this went beyond touchscreen. This was also just the ones for where you fill in the bubble.
Oh, okay.
And then finally, in Congress this week, a couple of our congressional leaders actually stood up and asked, you know, tried to point out that there were some problems in this last election, and they got heat for that.
They got howled at for it, actually. Barbara Boxer, the senator from California, did what no senator would do 4 years ago when there was much more extreme examples of voter intimidation and the election really did hang in the balance. She went along with the request from several representatives to hold up the Electoral College ballot counting, and did so, and they went back and caucused and said, no, there's nothing here, and then went back and approved the Electoral College count anyway. But it was just a reminder that what happened 4 years ago never should have happened.
It did force the Congress, both houses of Congress, to debate the issue, and it gave black representatives a chance to say there are problems in Ohio in particular with not enough voter booths at polling places in minority neighborhoods and other problems, particularly in those minority areas, that shouldn't happen, and it's something that needs to be changed. And it was good. They were allowed to bring up this issue, although the response from Republicans was extremely bad.
It was bad, yeah.
It was very bad. I mean, verged on racism. It really did.
So, moving along, sticking with a couple local issues here, the I just had to laugh before the tears came this week when I saw the expanded proposal by the Sonics saying that their proposal for a tax to pay for a potential new upgrade to the arena, which was only built 9 years ago.
Key Arena
should instead just...
Key Arena was renovated about 9 years ago, and the Sonics had pushed Mayor Nichols to make this proposal to expand Key Arena to give the Sonics new versions of things they already have, like a new practice court and new headquarters.
So they don't have to walk all the way across Seattle Center. It can actually just be next door to where they are now.
Right. Now, those of us who walk across Seattle Center a couple times a day to catch our bus, we think that's pretty funny. But
these are supposed to be athletes, you know, highly trained
right.
physical specimens that you would think could be able to walk across Seattle Center.
Right. And they want a parking garage right next to the stadium, you know, and there's parking all around the Seattle Center. So it's a joke, really. And in order to pay for this, Nichols proposed, and the Sonics had suggested, that they extend the tax on the stadium tax that exists right now to pay off the two new stadiums that we've built that are draining business away from Key Arena, in fact, and making Key Arena part of the problem for the deficit in the budget for the Seattle Center. Now, the Sonics came out this week and they said, well, we don't just want to extend the tax for a few more years. We want to have that tax continue indefinitely and just call it a tax devoted to stadium renovation, and it can be used for all three stadiums, et cetera. And that's ridiculous, basically. I mean,
the original proposal was ridiculous enough. But.
Yeah, they're talking about a hotel motel tax that'll get extended and part a portion of the sales tax. And the original proposal to use those taxes to pay for the stadiums was pretty ridiculous, considering that there's obviously business only for one or two stadiums in this town. And there's a question as to whether or not the public should be financing a facility devoted for these these privately held sports teams, you know, in the first place, and now they want to extend this tax indefinitely and devote it only to stadium maintenance.
Yeah, I mean, the trend now really is in all of these professional sports that the facilities are paid for by the public. It's something that the NFL and Major League Baseball and the NBA have all made a priority, is to make sure that in their franchise cities that taxpayers pick up the bill for the facilities that the team operates and profits from. And this is something that's part and parcel of that. The economics of it are that these facilities do not boost the economy. They do not make money for the city. And it's something that is.
They do make money for the businesses in the neighborhood where the stadium is, and of course those are private businesses. Those are not the public coffers. And when it comes to paying rent on the buildings, and then the city having to turn around, take that rent, and try to cover their costs for having built the building, to pay off the bonds, to pay interest to the bondholders, and to pay for maintenance on the stadiums, it turns out that they're a bad deal for the city.
Well, even that's debatable, because if you're looking at the two large stadiums, the Safeco Field and the Seahawks Stadium, there is a significant amount of data showing that the new small businesses that physically go into the stadium themselves are displacing businesses that are nearby
in the neighborhood.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
that makes perfect sense.
So anyway, enough on that.
Makes perfect sense, but it is not a good situation.
Yeah, but the Sonics are having a good year, so they're hoping that all that goodwill will spill over to the political arena also.
Buckhorn Mountain, we had reported a year or two back that things were looking good, and now it's not looking so good.
Tell people what Buckhorn Mountain is.
Buckhorn Mountain is a facility over in eastern Washington where there's an itsy-bitsy tiny amount of gold waiting to be leached out.
On this mountain.
On this mountain in the Okanagan, north central Washington, we're talking about. It's an environmentally sensitive area, and for well over a decade now, there have been various proposals. There was one in the mid-90s for an open pit mine that was shot down eventually by the Clinton administration after a huge grassroots opposition to it had been marshaled. Various other proposals have come up over the years only to be shot down. But now, under the new environmentally friendly, that's a joke, Bush administration, we have yet another attempt to install a gold mine there, and very quietly over the holidays, there was a transfer of land at Buckhorn Mountain from the BLM, from the government, into the private holdings of a company that hopes to put in an underground mine. This would not be an open pit mine, but it would still have many of the same problems of the cyanide leaching that they use to extract the gold, the open above ground pits that they use to store the toxic remainders from the process. This is something that environmentalists need to get busy on both sides of the mountain.
And in the past, the Buckhorn proposals were defeated because there was also help from locals who lived in the area and Indian tribes in the region who were against the environmental impact of the open pit mine. I think environmentalists need to get together with those folks again and look at the environmental impact of the below ground mines as well.
Yeah, there was a group, I believe it was called the Okanagan Highlands Alliance, that was out a few years ago, that was primarily locals, that did an outstanding job in trying to stop the mine, and it's time for that to be resuscitated.
All right, well, moving along. Propaganda in the news.
Yes, indeedy. The Bush administration never shy about spinning its story. We had a couple of items in the news this week. Armstrong Williams, the conservative black commentator, has gotten himself in trouble for taking a large amount of money, $100-some thousand.
I think it was
$240,000 from the Bush administration's Department of Education in order to spin the No Child Left Behind Act. Now, this involved running commercials, running pseudo news spots for inserted into his commentary programs as well.
And
for
then
his
he
TV
talked
program.
It up as well.
And then he talked it up as well. The spots featured Secretary of Education Rod Page, all talking about the benefits of the No Child Left Behind Act, without without disclosing that this material came directly from the government. Now, in journalist circles, we call this propaganda, and it's something that the government is not supposed to do, and it's something that broadcasters are not supposed to do. And so he's getting his hand slapped over this. He's had his newspaper column dropped by the Tribune News Services, which syndicated it. His TV program is probably in jeopardy, but there's been no accountability for the Bush administration. Scott McCollum, the president's press secretary, was referring all inquiries to the Department of Education yesterday, and they were saying, "Well, we still think it's a fine program," referring to No Child Left Behind, I think, not to Armstrong Williams. But at the same time that this came out, the General Accounting Office, the watchdog agency that Congress operates, bless their tin-hatted souls, came out with another report on a very similar topic, criticizing the Bush administration for putting out these pseudo television news reports. And it was to promote
the Bush administration's Medicare plan.
Yeah,
they had
that's
made
right.
these videos that were supposed to be news clips that news programs could use. And what they were is they were actors paid by the Bush administration pretending to interview officials and experts on the Bush administration Medicare plan. They were staged bits of news propaganda that were picked up by some 300 or more news stations and aired for about 22 million viewers in the United States while Congress was debating the Medicare plan.
Yeah, that's actually a standard practice amongst corporations. They produce these things called VNRs, video news releases.
Right.
That your nightly news, when you're watching it in a given half hour, I'd actually like to do a study on this, you know, can be several minutes of the clips you see while they're talking about stories in the background oftentimes aren't shot by their own people or their affiliates. They're from corporations.
Yeah. And locally, Q13 Fox News is particularly bad on this. You watch
bad
their average evening program, and they have several minutes every night of those kind of releases.
Yeah. But in this case, the government has gotten on the bandwagon and is doing it now, and that is wrong.
Yeah, it is
something that you would expect to have seen in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, and the Bush administration's defense for this is hilarious. It's, well, the Clinton administration did it too.
So, like that makes it right,
which they probably did, but nonetheless, that doesn't make it right, and it is not the sort of thing we should be encouraging in a democracy.
Mm. All right, moving along, jumping to the international, couple quick updates on the tsunami-related news.
Yes, there were some little bits and pieces in the news this week about some radical fundamentalist Muslim groups getting involved with bringing aid to the victims, particularly in Indonesia and Malaysia, where there's a large Muslim population. Those groups have told reporters that they're doing this because they see most of the aid that was coming in the first few days was coming from Western Christian aid organizations. And so folks who listen to the radio program might have read an article that I wrote about the problems with Christian aid organizations. In this case, we have, as a response to that, some radical fundamentalist Muslim groups going into areas, particularly in Indonesia, in the province of Aceh, which had never seen any Muslim fundamentalist groups on their territory at all. Those groups are now making inroads there as a direct response to some of the ways in which we make major donations, and the fact that our government, the Bush administration in particular, puts an emphasis on faith-based organizations as the primary groups to deliver aid to stricken populations. Now, you weigh that against the fact that governments could and probably should be doing this, and aid delivery should be a secular thing. It should not be something that you have to rely on the private sector, and that the Bush administration is pushing faith-based organizations to do. There is a problem when that occurs, and that's something that is happening right now.
And then also in Aceh, Jav?
Yeah. There was also an interesting item this week in Aceh province where the Indonesian military had the... there's a congressional ban in place against aid to the Indonesian military because of their horrific human rights record, particularly in East Timor and in Aceh province, where there's been a civil war going on for the last 20 years or so. Just in the last year and a half, there have been some 2,000 civilians who have died, mostly from military death squads at the hands of the Indonesian military. The ban on military aid to the Indonesian military was lifted this week by Congress. There was a limited lift in order to have them make use of cargo planes and whatnot. Now, the Indonesian military had assured the United States that this was not going to be used for operations against the guerrillas. Yet at the same time this week, the Indonesian military continued operations against guerrillas in Aceh province using relief operations as a cover for attacks in which seven or eight people were killed, I believe on Thursday, in Aceh province. So we have a massive relief effort going on in the midst of what is really a war zone. The Free Aceh Movement and the Indonesian government had agreed to a ceasefire in the few days after the earthquake and tsunami, but that is apparently broken down. And so this is something that's tremendously complicating relief efforts. And as Marib pointed out in her article, you know, the dynamics of having the Indonesian military and people in those uniforms giving out aid and giving out desperately needed food and water and medical supplies to a population that does not trust people in Indonesian military uniforms is highly problematic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the UN has warned the Indonesian government that they need to stop fighting with the Aceh rebels, which is a sign that the UN blames the Indonesian government for the outbreak in violence, that they may be using the disaster as a way to try to put down the Aceh movement, that they're being opportunistic here, and that is, I think, a crime. The Bush administration could certainly put some weight on. They could certainly lean on the Indonesian government to try and stop that.
Yeah, and instead they've been actually rewarding it by lifting the ban on military assistance.
All right. Well, then that takes us to This Week in Iraq.
This Week in Iraq.
So how are things going in Iraq right now? You know, we haven't heard a whole lot about it. Folks might assume that things are getting a little bit calmer, and they haven't been. Insurgent attacks are numbering about 80 per day, which is higher than in August of 2003 when the insurgency first ramped up and started being a problem for U.S. troops. Suicide car bombers hit a bus on Sunday, killing 26 people. On the same day, they assassinated two government officials and an Iraqi police major and bombed the main government building in the town of Sharkat near Mosul. Now, in a string of ambushes on Monday, insurgents killed 17 Iraqi police and National Guard troops and five U.S. troops in Baghdad, Tikrit, Mosul, Baiji, Balad, Samarra, Tal Afar, and Dujail. On Tuesday, they gunned down the governor of Baghdad province and six of his bodyguards, and a suicide bomber killed 10 at the Interior Ministry headquarters. On Wednesday, and it just goes on and on and on with these suicide bombing attacks. Now, let's see here. Just going to skip a little bit because I don't want to take up too much time. On Thursday, the bodies of 18 Iraqis were found in Mosul. These were men that had been looking for work at the U.S. base in Mosul, but they had fallen into the hands of insurgents instead. There's a problem with the fact that the U.S. reconstruction efforts have not been going forward and helping to create jobs. The only jobs that are really available are jobs working for the U.S. military, and that puts Iraqi civilians as targets in this war. And they have been the highest number of dead in the continuing attacks in Iraq. Meanwhile, the U.S. military still officially estimates that the number of hardcore insurgents is about 8,000 to 10,000 people. However,
they've got to be kidding.
No, I'm not kidding you. And this week, General Mohammed Abdullah Shawani disagreed with that assessment. He's the national intelligence chief for the interim Iraqi government. Now, he estimates that the insurgents are about 200,000 people, which is a force that is larger than the entire U.S. military presence in Iraq. He's the national intelligence chief for the interim Iraqi government. Now, at the same time, the oil minister, Thamer Ghadban, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, He told reporters, quote, "We want to tell the Iraqi people that there is an all-out war against the country's oil infrastructure." Now, what he was referring to were continuing insurgent attacks against oil pipelines, oil wells, oil refineries, and tanker trucks throughout the whole country of Iraq over the past few weeks. There are now no oil exports from the northern oil fields, which has put a severe crimp on the interim government's revenue. And the oil infrastructure in most of northern Iraq is completely shut down. That's including large areas around the city of Baghdad. There are problems with getting enough fuel to Baghdad residents, not just for people's automobiles. In fact, because the electrical infrastructure is still so bad and has not been rebuilt after the war, much of Baghdad is in a blackout situation all night, nearly every night, and for large parts of the day as well. Most people rely on generators in order to heat their homes during the winter and to cook their food, etc. Those generators run on gasoline, and because the insurgents have been attacking tanker trucks as well as the oil infrastructure in the country, there are long, long, long lines at the gas pumps. Most of the time, people reach the gas pumps and there's nothing left, or they can't afford to buy the gasoline because the price is so high. So that's a major problem. In response, the Bush administration is seeking to move even more funds from reconstruction to pay for security. Last summer, Congress agreed to a Bush administration request to divert $1.8 billion from long-term electrical and water projects to help train and equip Iraqi troops. So yes, the problems that are leading people to join the insurgency, things like blackouts every day in Baghdad and a lack of clean water, seeing their children die from waterborne diseases, etc., those projects are being put on hold in order to pour even more money into training Iraqi troops. But that program to train Iraqi troops has been a massive failure. It's also been the most expensive piece of the reconstruction effort, which has cost, that piece alone has cost about $5 billion so far. Now, if you look at what the Bush administration has spent on other reconstruction projects out of a fund that totaled $18 billion that Congress approved in an emergency request, the Bush administration said, you know, late last year, we need to have $18 billion in this fund immediately.
Yeah, we can't wait until the regular appropriations process.
That's right. We got to have it right away. The Bush administration has only spent a little over $2 billion on reconstruction projects, while at the same time having spent $5 billion on a failed program to train Iraqi troops. And to put this all in perspective, I just want to remind folks that we were only sending $350 million to aid the victims of the Asian tsunami. Now $2 billion or $5 billion would have a much greater impact sent to aid the victims of the tsunami than it seems to be having in Iraq, because the Iraqi resistance is so strong and so against our occupation. So I want to leave you with that as the end of This Week in Iraq. Do we have any time left, Mike?
Got another minute or so.
Okay. We need to talk also about our fundraising effort. We are still doing our year-end fundraiser.
But wait, it's a new year.
It is. Yeah, I know. It's a new year. It's really our winter fundraiser still underway. We have a couple weeks left on it. And I know folks have given a lot to the tsunami relief effort, but if you still have some money left over, we could use it at Eat the State. So, Jav, where can they send funds to Eat the State?
The address is P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington, 98145, or you can do it over the web. We have a PayPal account set up for the website. And all of our issues are there too, so you can actually see what you're donating to. It's www.eatthestate.org.
Yeah, we're an all volunteer operation, but we still have costs for printing and distributing the newspaper version of Eat the State. And if we didn't do the newspaper version, we probably wouldn't do the website version, and you wouldn't get some of this detailed news in a format where you can pass it on to your friends and family. So help us out and send us some money to keep us printing the paper.
And if you weren't doing either of those two, you wouldn't be here talking with us either.
Well, probably. We might be here talking with you anyway, but a lot of times people...
Oh, no, I have a strict contract.
A lot of times people send us email and say, gosh, where did you get that information? Can you elaborate on that? And I often send them to our website because a lot of what we talk about, we write about, and it's in a format there where they can read it, review it, look at the sources,
send it
to their
friends. Yep.
All right. Well, talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors at Eat This State, and quickly, where do people find Eat This State?
You find it where people find free periodicals around town, bookstores, cafes, places like that. Again, on the web also, the same place you can make your donations, www.eatthestate.org. And if you have comments, tips, you have questions about our big corporate operation, you can give us a call. Our voicemail is area code 206-903-9461.